Next case is 19-6046 Carr versus Remington Arms Company. You may proceed, Mr. Brinkley.
May it please the court, Chris Brinkley on behalf of Ryan and Jessica Carr. On July 28th of 2020, when Remington declared bankruptcy for the second time in 2 years, this court stayed this appeal and ordered Remington to provide notice to the Carrs and to this court within 5 days of the conclusion of the bankruptcy proceedings. Remington did so, and this case proceeded forward in a timely manner. Contrast that with what happened in the district court in this case, where the district judge held that during Remington's first bankruptcy, Remington's failure to provide any of the notice required by the bankruptcy rules to the Carrs' counsel of record in this case was irrelevant. Rather, the district court held that the Carrs, who were not parties to the Remington bankruptcy, had an affirmative duty to monitor the bankruptcy docket. As a result, when the Carrs filed their motion to reinstate the case upon discovering that the first bankruptcy had concluded, the district court denied it as untimely. In another way, the district court excused Remington's failure to provide notice of the bankruptcy proceedings to the Carrs, as is required by due process under the Arch Wireless case, and then turned around and punished the Carrs by imposing on them a new duty for non-parties to monitor the docket of a separate litigation in which they were entitled to notice in the first place. Now, after the district court denied the motion to reinstate the case, the Carrs also moved for relief from the judgment and filed another motion to reinstate the case. The substantive bases, of course, are all covered in the briefing, but I want to focus on one particular issue that I think sort of encapsulates all of the major nuances of this appeal, and that is whether the judgment should have been vacated pursuant to Rule 60B1 for excusable neglect. In 1993...
Before you get to that, if you will, please, where does the 30 days come from? Is the 30 days either statutory or regulatory, or is it just an arbitrary selection of a time period?
Are you talking about the 30 days in the court's administrative closing order?
No, I'm talking about the 30 days to file the petition to reopen.
That came out of the court's administrative closing order, the district court's administrative closing order.
I understand, but where does 30 versus 45 or 90 come from? Does it come from, I just restate my question, does it come from statute or regulation, or was it just an arbitrary selection of a date?
I am not aware of a source for that. I think it's sort of just a standard practice. We've seen that in other administrative closing orders.
And you do not challenge the adequacy of the 30 days. That is to say, you're not saying it should have been a great longer period or a greater period or anything of the like.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
So in the Pioneer Investment Services case out of the U.S. Supreme Court, the court gave us four factors for considering whether or not neglect is excusable. The first is danger of prejudice to the non-moving party. The second is the length of delay and potential impact on the proceedings. The third is the reason for the delay, including whether it was within the reasonable control of the movement. And then the fourth is the good faith of the movement. The Supreme Court in that case also said that excusable neglect includes carelessness. And the district court, Remington, did not contest three of those factors. And in fact, the district court found that three of the factors weighed in favor of the Carrs and in favor of reinstating the case. The only factor that was at issue in the district court was the third one, the reason for the delay and whether it was in the control of the Carrs. And the district court treated that factor as being dispositive, but it's clearly not dispositive, or it would be the only factor. And if you go back again to the Pioneer Investment Services case, the U.S. Supreme Court held that where there's the first factor, where there's a lack of prejudice to the parties, there's a lack of prejudice to the administration of justice, which is the second factor. And when there's good faith of the movement, which is the fourth factor, that, quote, weighs strongly in favor of permitting the tardy claim, which is the exact opposite of what the court did.
Mr. Brinkley, would your argument be the same if the delay was 12 months in this case?
I think it would be much more difficult if the delay was 12 months, because there are certainly authorities out there that say that if you have reason to know that something ought to be happening and you're not finding out about it, you need to make an effort to do that. And we did that in this case in a much shorter time period than 12 months.
But we have, what, almost six months delay here, right?
There was about 6 months total between the notice of the filing of bankruptcy and the inquiry that I made to try to figure out why in the world are we not hearing anything. The caveat to that is that the real delay that you need to focus on is the time frame between when the dismissal with prejudice in this case became final and when we filed the motion to reinstate. And that's actually 2 months. So going to the reason for the delay itself, it was because Remington did not provide the cars with the notices that they're entitled to by the bankruptcy rules. And as the
counsel, could I just ask on that point? I think you said a minute or two ago that you were relying on the Arch Wireless case, I think, for that obligation. And just now you said bankruptcy rules require notice. What exactly are you relying upon by way of authority for the proposition that the cars were entitled to notice of the various steps in the bankruptcy proceeding?
Bankruptcy Rule 2002 in subsections A and F says that all creditors are entitled to a variety of notices, including notice of the hearing on dismissal of the case, deadline to file proofs of claim, orders for relief, orders confirming the reorganization plan, and things like that. The purpose is wireless because when you don't get the notices required by Bankruptcy Rule 2002, that is a violation of due process.
If the case had not been stayed, what was the procedural posture of the case at the precise moment of the stay? In whose court was the ball?
We had been through a significant amount of discovery. We were working on some, getting some follow-up and supplementation from Remington. Both parties had retained experts. We had done depositions.
That's a very long answer. I'm trying to find out who's next, who had the next move.
I think we both did. We were working toward a trial date a few months down the road.
As I understand civil procedure, both parties don't have the move at the same obligation at the same time. If we have an answer, then the next step is if you have a complaint, the next step is the answer. If there's a motion, then there's typical briefing. There's typical procedure that's followed. And I'm just curious as to what was the procedural status at the precise moment of the stay?
We were deep in discovery, getting ready to disclose experts.
So you had the next move?
I had requested supplementation of Remington's discovery that was critical information our expert needed.
So then they had the next move to provide the discovery information that you had requested.
That is what we were working on.
All right. Thank you.
So going back to the right to receive notices from the bankruptcy, the District of Utah in the NRA Johnson Thackeray McKenzie Properties case, which is 166 BR at 963, it says creditors have a right to assume they're going to receive all notices required by the bankruptcy notice rule. So the reliance by the cars on getting the notices they're supposed to get was not unreasonable. Now, Remington seeks to avoid that by arguing that they'd served at least one bankruptcy notice on another attorney in appellant's counsel's law firm who has an office in another city who was not a counsel of record. But both that attorney and his secretary filed affidavits and said, we got a first notice, but we never got any additional notices, which included one that required counsel to opt in to receive any further notices, which is why we didn't get things like the notice of the effective date of the plan, which would have told us when the bankruptcy stay was lifted, or the final decree, which would have gone towards the issue of the completion of the bankruptcy. As for the new duty that the district court imposed on the Carrs to monitor the bankruptcy docket, the district court relied on the prior products case, but that case is distinguishable for a couple of reasons. First of all, it predates the Supreme Court's decision in Pioneer Investment Services, but more importantly, the party that failed to timely move to reinstate their case in prior products was also the party in bankruptcy. That's the reason that the Fifth Circuit said prior products should have known that dismissal of its own bankruptcy was imminent and should have been diligently monitoring the bankruptcy docket. In this case, the Carrs were not also the party in bankruptcy and were not similarly positioned to know the status of someone else's bankruptcy.
Did the Carrs ever receive the notice of the confirmation by the bankruptcy court?
In the first bankruptcy, no. Now, from a policy standpoint, I think we need to think about the precedential effect that upholding the district court could have in this case, because this court would be effectively abandoning the notice and service requirements found in the bankruptcy rules and adopting a procedure by which non-parties, which is all creditors, would have to start actively monitoring a bankruptcy docket. But there are similar notice rules throughout the various sets of federal procedural rules, criminal and civil, that this decision could wind up being carried over to. And if we're going to apply this kind of a rule to a non-party, wouldn't it also make sense to apply this a rule like this to parties who already have intimate knowledge of their own lawsuit, which of course was the whole point of the prior products case in the first place? I think there's a very slippery slope here that we need to be aware of. So the appellant's contention in this case, obviously, is the district court's rulings were inconsistent with the authorities set forth in the briefing. They constitute an abuse of discretion by the court, district court, and we would request that this court reverse the district court. And I would request to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from Remington.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Steve Danikas on behalf of Remington. Let me address a couple of points raised by Mr. Brinkley before I go back to the beginning of my presentation. He mentioned that he contrasted the bankruptcy in 2018 with the more recent one, and he said that Remington provided notice to this court, the Tenth Circuit, of the completion of the bankruptcy, the 2020 bankruptcy, and contrasted that with the bankruptcy in 2018. The difference, Your Honors, is that the Tenth Circuit had issued an order imposing a duty upon us to provide such notice, and we complied with it. In the underlying case before the district court, the court's administrative order did not impose such duty. It indicated that either party should and must, if they wanted to continue with the case, notify the court of the completion of the bankruptcy or if the stay was lifted. Mr. Brinkley admitted during his oral argument that the dismissal did become final at least 2 months before they filed their motion to reinstate in October of 2018. There was no obligation for Remington to notify the plaintiff that the 2018 bankruptcy had been quote unquote completed. The Arch case, we addressed that in our brief, was a bankruptcy matter. Here, counsel, if I may,
I'm just thinking through the due process aspects of this case. Typically in a virgin case, if you're analyzing due process under traditional standards, you look for notice and opportunity for hearing, et cetera, et cetera. The first element of that is notice. And here, we are told there is no notice. There's no precipitory event. What say you to that?
Well, we believe that there was.
Whose duty is it to provide notice? I mean, that's here where the court says, you guys monitor this case. And it just strikes me that that isn't the way due process notice normally works.
Well, I believe that there was notice provided to the plaintiffs. We provided proof of that before the district court. The district court gave the benefit of the doubt to the plaintiffs, which is fine. The point of this is that the
What is the notice you gave that, well, that the bankruptcy proceedings had terminated and that the parties could now proceed to reinstitute their case if they wished?
The plaintiffs had notice of the bankruptcy. They had notice of the hearing for confirmation of the
I thought you said you gave notice, and I'm just asking what notice you gave.
Oh, did we give the plaintiff?
Yes.
No, the bankruptcy court, the bankruptcy in that matter, there was the docket, there was the online.
So when you say that you gave notice, that's a misspeak?
No, the notice was given through the bankruptcy court. The plaintiff had notice of the bankruptcy. We had actually given notice of bankruptcy to the.
My question was, what notice was the plaintiff given that the bankruptcy proceedings had terminated and that they could elect then to proceed with their case?
They had been given notice of the hearing on the confirmation of the plan proposed by the debtors in bankruptcy. They had been given a notice that subsequent thereto, if they wanted to receive notice of filings, they would have to make that known to the bankruptcy court and the online service provider. There was an online.
So there was opportunity for notice. My question is, what actual notice, if any, was given that the bankruptcy proceedings had terminated?
The fact that the plan was approved and the plaintiffs had access to that plan was notice that the bankruptcy had been completed.
Right. Thank you.
Related question. Mr. Brinkley pointed to bankruptcy rules calling for notice to creditors. Were the Cars creditors, and were they entitled to notice under the bankruptcy rules?
I don't recall, honestly, Your Honor, if the Cars had filed a proof of claim in that bankruptcy. The notice that is mentioned under the bankruptcy code is for bankruptcy matters. This is a civil litigation matter, albeit affected by the bankruptcy, in which the district court provided an administrative order, which has been an administrative order similar to administrative orders entered in other cases. Mr. Brinkley acknowledged that these types of administrative orders are not uncommon. So, with regard to the Arch case and the bankruptcy code, I do not believe those imposed upon Remington, the defendant in this civil litigation, any obligation to provide notice to the Cars. They had notice of the bankruptcy, they had notice of the hearing and the confirmation plan, and they had access to the docket, the online service provided by the company that provides service of bankruptcy papers. They were notified that they could notify the bankruptcy court via phone or email if they had any questions. The fact of the matter is that it was very, very easy for the Cars to have kept abreast of the bankruptcy matter and to have found that the final decree was entered in July of 2018.
Well, even if all of that is so, if we look at the factor of reason for delay, mm-hmm. if they were entitled to some form of notice in the context of the bankruptcy proceedings and didn't get that notice, why wouldn't that be a legitimate reason for the delay?
If they had, the Arch case, if they had a claim in the bankruptcy and they did not receive notice through the debtor in that bankruptcy that affected their claim in the bankruptcy court, I agree with you. This is a related litigation where the Cars had filed a civil suit against Remington. The bankruptcy affected this litigation, obviously, providing a stay. The courts that have addressed these types of administrative orders, the prior products case we mentioned, that was mentioned from the Fifth Circuit, the Adams Court in the Second Circuit, both impose upon the plaintiff in a civil litigation a duty to monitor these types of proceedings. Adams actually involved a pro se plaintiff. This court, we mentioned in our brief, the Cashner case from the Tenth Circuit in 1996. And there, I believe that was a Rule 60 case, this court said a party remains under a duty to take legal steps to protect his own interests. Here, the fact is undisputed that for months, the plaintiff did not, there's no evidence in the record, they presented no evidence to the district court at the time that the plaintiff's motion to reinstate was presented to the court. They presented no evidence that they had taken any action to determine the status of the bankruptcy. And the court indicated, the district court indicated that if they had taken or provided some evidence of just some action, perhaps the outcome would have been different. But the court concluded that the fact that they took no action to determine the status of the bankruptcy did not rise to a level of excusable neglect. It was, I think the court referred to it or alluded to it as wholly careless. The Pioneer case that Mr. Brinkley mentions is a case in the bankruptcy context, and the Pioneer court did not say.
Would your argument be the same if we're talking about a 10-day delay versus a 2 or 6 month delay?
Yes, it would be, Your Honor. The court's order, the administrative order, was very clear that if the parties did not notify the court of the completion of the bankruptcy within 30 days, the administrative order would convert to a dismissal with prejudice. And Mr. Brinkley conceded in his oral argument that the dismissal had become final at 2 months or so before they filed the motion to reinstate. And that was not contested before the district court when the plaintiff brought the motion to reinstate before the district court. There was never any argument at all that the order, the administrative order, had become a final order of dismissal. So
if there's no prejudice to Remington, you know, why isn't this more or less a case of excusable negligence or simple negligence? And it would fall within the kind of range of permissible reasons to reopen a case.
Because if you are, well, first of all, to answer your question, Your Honor, the most important factor this circuit has alluded to and other circuits have alluded to is the reason for delay. And the district court mentioned that. The reason for delay can in fact be determinative. And that has been set forth by this circuit and other circuits. So the reason for delay here, there was actually no reason given other than the fact that they had not followed the bankruptcy proceeding, and the plaintiffs thought that they would be notified by Remington in this civil litigation of that. There's no obligation for that. There was no obligation imposed by the administrative order. In fact, the administrative order made very clear that either party could notify the court of the completion of the bankruptcy. With regard to your hypothetical, Your Honor, if it was only 10 days, Mr. Brinkley was alluding to the precedential value of this decision before the court today. 10 days or 30 days or 2 months, I don't think makes any difference in this scenario, because the reason for delay is that they just didn't follow their duty to monitor the litigation or the bankruptcy proceeding. So if 10 days is considered to be okay, then, you know, where does that slippery slope end? So the precedential value of a decision from this court that a 2 month delay is okay and a 10 day delay would have been okay, I think creates a dangerous precedent, because it undermines the authority and the ability of the district court to handle and monitor its own docket. The, This was an administrative order. It was an administrative order that all parties acknowledge is common in these matters. And I think a decision reversing the district court and allowing the plaintiff to proceed with this case would be dangerous precedent. And to get back to this, the standard of review, we are talking about an abuse of discretion. And before the district court on the motion to reinstate, keep in mind that the facts were that the order of dismissal had become final. The administrative order had become a dismissal with prejudice, and it was final. That was not contested. The plaintiff had presented no evidence of any activity to determine or check the status of the bankruptcy. There was the docket, the noticing agent's website available, the phone, the email. The plaintiffs did nothing. The legal basis asserted by the plaintiff to reinstate the case was under Rule 60. As we all know, that involves it's an exceptional remedy. It is granted only in exceptional circumstances. And as the court indicated in the cases we cited, the plaintiffs did have a duty to monitor the bankruptcy, and they did not do so. The Pioneer case, I'm going to touch upon that very briefly at the end here, because I know I'm running out of time. Was in a different context. The Pioneer case was in a bankruptcy matter. It involved a party not filing a proof of claim on time. And the Pioneer case does not stand for the proposition that neglect equals excusable neglect. If it did, then it would read would eliminate the language from Rule 60. So under these circumstances, where there was no evidence presented of any monitoring of the bankruptcy matter, there was no excusable neglect, and the court was well within its discretion in making the ruling that it did.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Brinkley, you had some rebuttal.
Mr. Brinkley, you're muted.
I'm so sorry. First of all, I want to touch on the idea that excusable neglect is exceptional relief requiring extraordinary circumstances. Remington actually cited the Yap case in support of that. And I would just want to point out that the language about extraordinary relief and exceptional circumstances in that case was actually pulled out of a Tenth Circuit case called Kashner from 1996. Kashner, in turn, took that language from a 1950 U.S. Supreme Court case, Ackerman versus U.S. And of course, Ackerman has been superseded by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Pioneer Investment Services, where the court said excusable neglect does include carelessness. The other thing I want to mention briefly is this concept of what the administrative closing order did in this case. Yes, this administrative closing order was not uncommon. What was uncommon in this case was not getting the bankruptcy notices. I've never had that happen before. Admittedly,
were the cars listed in the bankruptcy as unsecured creditors, and would they typically receive notice? Why didn't they get notice from the bankruptcy proceedings?
They were listed in the bankruptcy service matrix, and actually it was Michael Carr, who is no relation to Ryan and Jessica, the other attorney in our firm, that was listed as the person to serve. Michael, of course, has never been counsel of record in this case. Why in the world they didn't list myself and Ty Smith, who were the attorneys handling this case in the service matrix, I can't explain to you. But Michael says he received the first notice and then received no others. And his secretary said the same thing.
And whose, whose obligation was it to place you on that mailing list?
Remington's.
And under what authority do you answer the question in that way?
I believe it's addressed in Bankruptcy Rule 2002. But I'm not overly familiar with it, but I seem to recall reading it there. The other thing I wanted to mention about the administrative closing order is, while it did not place, the district court did not place a separate duty on Remington in that order to provide notice back to the court, which I, Mr. Danicus mentioned. The fact of the matter is that administrative closing order was inextricably tied to the events from the bankruptcy that we were entitled to get notice about. And so once we don't get notice, what else can we do? And we wind up...
Well, you know, if one of your partners received the first notice, did you as counsel record take any steps to correct the mailing list with the bankruptcy court so that you could then monitor the proceedings?
We did not, but we also received no further notices through that attorney either. When the first one came in, he immediately sent it to me.
Okay.
And then he got no further. I believe my time's up. Thank you very much, Your Honors.
All right. Any other questions from the panel? Thank you, counsel. You're excused and the case is submitted.